Hey, I'm Zale, host of Preconceived, a podcast that challenges the preconceptions that shape how we view the world. Preconceived examines both our approach to major life choices, but also our perspectives on issues to which we may have been overly conditioned towards certain opinions. Each episode features a different topic, with experts, researchers, and luminaries in their respective fields. We think you'll especially enjoy recent episodes on polyamory, regretting parenthood, dopamine nation, and myths of the beauty industry. Find Preconceived wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello, folks. Very excited about this week's episode. We are talking to Mr. John Paul Boyd. He is an accredited family law arbitrator, a family law mediator, and a parenting coordinator, and his focus in family law disputes is on the big picture. So this week, Bridie and I talked to John Paul about conversations we should absolutely be having with our significant others. We hope you enjoy it, and as always, Bridie and I will see you on the other side. All right, John Paul Boyd, very excited to sit down and talk to you. Firstly, because I feel like the work that you do is going to bring a lot of insight into the work that we do, and it's a conversation that I think we've kind of been waiting to have with someone who could speak to this kind of stuff that we're about to get into. But also kind of excited because you and I are both going to be on the same. I don't know how much of this I'm allowed to fucking talk about, but we're going to be on the same as CBC miniseries all about sex in Canada. Which is very exciting. But we'll save that for when that comes out.
We'll revisit things then.
Yeah, a little bonus for our listeners there. But John, you are an accredited family law arbiter. How do you say that?
Arbitrator.
Yes. And a family law mediator. And I know that. So what we're going to be diving into specifically is family law surrounding relationships that fall outside of the what is considered to be like typical monogamous setup. And this is something, you know, Bridie and I, we're in a polyamorous relationship. We've been married for 10 years. We both have partners outside of one another. Yet this is like something we've never really talked about or dived into.
No. And recently I started with my other partner exploring some like business plans and owning property together and all of this kind of stuff, and realizing like with that comes a whole other level of complication. And not only that, but it also shone a light for me on how I like how, you know, we got married pretty young, and there was no like manual where you go, here's a list of things you guys should talk about and figure out before you get legally bound to one another. And I don't think most people do that work unless it's their second time around, maybe. So I'm really intrigued by that, even for our monogamous listeners, but then add polyamory in there and like how complicated do things get for those folks especially when things go awry in the relationship?
Well, I mean, I've been practicing family law for, I guess, more than 20 years now. And, you know, I didn't always live in the happy groves of mediation and arbitration. I used to be a litigator, right? And when I started to practice family law, it was an assumption that everybody that walked into the front door was going to be resolving their dispute in court, right? Except the curious thing is that the disputes, you know, were all sort of revolving around the same four subject areas, right? Parenting after separation, child support, spousal support, and the division of property. But what surprised me was, you know, just how, you know, some people are relatively equanimous and, you know, can get along with each other and do just fine with vague arrangements. And, you know, it's like, oh yeah, sure, no, you can have the car and I'll take the barbecue or something like that. But then there were other people who were just so predisposed to fighting and arguing. And, you know, these, you know, we're not talking about little tiny battles that are sort of over and done with in the length of a Law and Order episode. I mean, these are, you know, spats and fights, drag out and knock them down disputes that would go on for years and years and years. I mean, I've had files where I've watched the kids grow up as I represented one of their parents, which is an absolutely perverse place to find yourself. And it's not what the justice system is all about. So the interesting thing was, is that when I first sort of began to run into poly families, you know, my initial sort of reaction was, wow, man, this really is the village it takes to raise a child. Mm-hmm. And there's truth to that. And I was attracted to, you know, the life for those children growing up with a multitude of parents, right? And the richness of the parenting resources that would be available to those kids. And you know, the longer that, you know, I continue to be involved in polyamorous families, you know, the more and more I learned. And then when I took a break from the court system and wound up running the Canadian Research Institute for Law and the Family at the University of Calgary and actually started doing some research on people who identify as polyamorous, you know, I began stumbling into these other things, like about the extraordinary support within the community for the importance of transparency and honesty and communication. And then it hit me that a lot of the people that I'm dealing with as a family law lawyer never had those preliminary conversations that you have to have when you're starting a polyamorous relationship, right? Mm. Because polyamorous relationships don't just sort of happen, right? But a dyadic relationship, a pair relationship, well, you know, quite often people don't realize that they're in that kind of a relationship until they wake up one day and realize that all of his socks are in her underwear drawer. It's like, holy shit, I guess we're living together, right? Mm-hmm. But in society, right? I mean, we're so used to these dyadic assumptions that pervade everything, right? From how government figures out EI benefits to how you calculate entitlement to or obligations with respect to welfare, or how we divide family property in family law cases, or who are the right number of spouses that are entitled to inherit when somebody dies without a will. I mean, all these assumptions about pair relationships are hardwired into almost every aspect of society. Like when next time you look at a kid's form for, God, a Girl Scouts or parents, right? How many slots are there for the parents and or guardians? Two, only two, right? And there are so many Canadians that just don't fit into that little pair. But what I was getting at is that, you know, all you have to do is go to the greeting card aisle of your local grocery store, right? And, you know, it's a microcosm of the dyadic assumptions that drape our society from beginning to end. And so I began to realize that, you know, keeping in line with the whole idea about, you know, not realizing that you're in a relationship until you've discovered that your socks are in your partner's underwear drawer. You know, we live a life full of scripts, right? Scripts about how you meet and how you fall in love and how wonderful it is. God, and all you have to do is watch any one of a handful of Hallmark movies to sort of see that script play out, right? And it's so idealized and it's so infantilizing, right? But it's also so emblematic of all of the assumptions that we make as a society. But the people I was involved with when I was doing the research about polyamorous families, you don't sort of stumble into a polyamorous relationship, right? It's something you talk about. You have to talk about it. Mm. You got to plan. And so questions like the ones that you're facing, Bridie, about starting up a business, you know, if you were in a vanilla dyadic relationship, it'd be like, oh, I'm thinking about doing that. What do you think? Oh, that sounds pretty good. Let's do it, right? Or that sounds crazy. Don't do it, right? But here, you have to navigate all of these issues that dyadic couples hardly ever think about because, you know, we're all so busy following the social script. We don't even realize that the social script exists, but not in a poly relationship. And that's the fascinating part about it.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to this, like this notion of the dyadic relationship among society as like a standard, what is the law when it comes to, let's say Bridie, myself, and Bridie's partner, Todd, decide to have a baby. And we bring a human into this world. Right now in Nova Scotia, would it be legally possible for us to have on that baby's birth certificate, like Todd is the father, Jeremy is the father, the second father, and Bridie is the mother? Like, is that a thing that exists in Canada, or is that something that's kind of relatively new in terms of not a lot of people have actually like crossed that bridge and there's precedence that needs to be set?
Okay, so the basic way that Canada works, right, is that our Constitution Act divides the powers involved in running a country between the federal government and the provincial governments, right? And so the idea is that what the federal government can make rules about, the provinces can't, and so on, right? So kids, parenting, parentage, registration of births, all of that is provincial in nature, right?
Okay, yeah.
And so as a result, it changes, it can change, and it does change depending on the province you happen to live in. So I don't know enough about Nova Scotia law to be able to tell you convincingly that no, you can't, but I'm pretty sure that you can't. On the other hand, all you have to do is go to the other side of the country, find yourself in British Columbia, where the Family Law Act there allows a child to have as many as, I think it's six parents. People who are parents for all purposes of the law, right? Up to two intended parents, a donor of sperm, a donor of eggs, a surrogate's mother, and the spouse of the surrogate mother. All of those people can be made the parents of a child by an agreement that is made prior to conception. You don't even have to go to court and argue about this stuff. It's amazing, right? And so what that means, and what I've seen in some families coming from British Columbia, is there are arrangements that people make where, you know, the two men will commingle their sperm, for example, and use that to impregnate the mom, right? And so in British Columbia, because you have this flexible circumstance, both, you know, all three people could be designated as the parent of a child. And in fact, there was an even more recent case not involving assisted reproduction where the court said, oh, you know, clearly the provincial legislature wasn't thinking about poly families when it made the Family Law Act. So there's a hole there. And the court made an order that said that, no, if people can choose to have multiple parents, even if they're not using assisted reproduction to make the child. Fascinating stuff. But you're not going to find a particularly warm and fuzzy reception in Alberta, where, you know, I'm talking to you from. Ontario is probably the province that's the next most friendly. But it's going to change everywhere you are across Canada. So unless you have legislation or a court order that specifically allows you to either, you know, have a baby through assisted reproduction and name the parents, or get a court order deciding, you know, that persons A, B, and C are all the parents of the child, you're hooped. And most of the time, most provinces say the parents of a child are the birth mother and the biological father.
Hmm. Wow. Now, in British Columbia, where there was that gap, and that gap seems to have been filled, due to the previous circumstances that they had with like surrogate parents and the people involved in actually like making and bringing this baby to life, how complicated does that make things when, you know, that mother and that father in a polyamorous relationship decide, okay, well, one of us is separating from this situation, and now we have to decide who takes custody,
who pays child support.
Yeah, who pays child support, like all of those things involved in separation. Like, does that make it even that much more complicated than it would be if it was, again, like your typical just mother and father situation, or is it as simple as that? You're just adding another person to the mix.
Oh, I actually, it's probably going to surprise you that it's more simple than it is complicated. Hmm. Right? Family law in Canada goes back to England and France. And that in turn has its roots in Roman law, which in turn has its roots in legislation. Like, and that is, I kid you not, 4,000 years old, right? That's how long family law has been a part of the legislated landscape, right? So once upon a time, issues about parentage were hugely important, right? If you were a bastard, meaning that your father was unacknowledged or unidentified, you didn't have the right to your father's title. You didn't have the right to inheritance. You were treated as less than, right? And that was the law for a good long time. And it wasn't really until recently where we had the technology to identify conclusively who the parents of the child are. And so prior to that, that was a huge issue about who had to pay child support and so on and so forth. The other bit that plays into the mix is that it's not really until the 1960s when relationships between adults, marriages, were perceived as anything other than until death do you part. Right. And so with the evolution of the idea that, you know, relationships do end, people do get divorced, common law relationships form and then get rent asunder, you know, the law has kept pace with that. And so we're actually much more comfortable with the idea that a child can not only have two biological parents, but also step parents and non-married people who stand in the place of parents. Right. And so the curious thing about that kind of thing is that because governments federally and provincially place such a huge emphasis on the well-being of children, we have a situation where the government has, since the 1970s, been delighted to extend the obligation to pay child support to as many people that fall into the child's life as people who are guardians or who stand in the place of parents. And so the law is quite comfortable with child support obligations, and it's gotten almost as comfortable dealing with issues about parenting after separation, who gets to see the child, when, why, and how are decisions made about the child and things like that. But in a situation where we're talking about relationships that are contemporaneous rather than sequential, right? Well, I mean, you know, I doubt very much that any court in the country is going to limit its consideration about the child's parenting needs to just the two people who happen to be biological parents, right? Because the law of the land is always about nothing more than what's in the best interests of the child. So if you've got three people or four people or five people who are playing involved parenting roles in a child's life, I've got no doubt that all of those people would have substantial and important, meaningful time with that kid.
Mm. And would they be required as well to pay child support?
Oh, yeah. 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 Wow. No, the law is very comfortable about the idea that multiple people can be required to pay child support. Right. Mm. So we're good with that. In fact, the federal child support guidelines have an explicit provision that deals with how do you calculate the child support obligation of people who are step parents rather than biological parents. Mm.
At what point would be, I mean, ideally, it would seem best point to have that conversation would be pre having a baby. Like, but like if it doesn't, I kind of lost track of what I was going to ask there, but most people, when they're planning to have a baby, are not planning for a potential dissolution of the relationship someday down the road. But so I guess I'm just cautioning all of our listeners, any of our listeners, that like, even say Jeremy and I had never opened our relationship and we had had a kid and then we were going into a separation, or what about a pre-existing kid coming into a polyamorous parenting situation? Like, I guess I just can't even wrap my head around that
right.
preparation for that.
Well, so the thing is, the law is really well established about the idea of, you know, two parents who have a child and then break up, and then one of the parents repartners and so on and so forth. Like, we're comfy with that, right? Where things stretch a little bit is like, what do you do when there's multiple adults who are simultaneously involved in parenting a child? The courts in most jurisdictions, and you know, the ones that leap immediately to mind as being friendly to the situation are the courts of Ontario and the courts of British Columbia. They're not going to have an issue with that. But as far as the people who are involved, you know, I mean, it's all part and parcel about going into relationships with your eyes wide open, which is precisely what tends not to happen in dyadic relationships, unless, as you were pointing out, it's a case of once bitten, twice shy. You've already been through the relationship ringer and you know what to do next time, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, most people don't go into committed relationships sort of anticipating that it's going to break down at some point, right? I mean, you kind of cross your fingers and hope. But as far as the kids are concerned, you have to have the conversations right from the very beginning. What are your expectations? Mm. I mean, to give you an example, I've done a combination parenting agreement and relationship agreement for a family in which everybody who was involved agreed that one member of the family in particular, and it was a quad, would not play a parental role, but their role would be kind of avuncular, like an uncle or an aunt. You know, so they'd be there and they'd care. And of course, they'd wind up loving the child. But everybody expected right off the bat that there wasn't going to be that kind of parent-child intense relationship. So all I can say to you and to your listeners is that, you know, you cannot go into a poly relationship except with a lot of conversation, including about things that, you know, dyadic people rarely pause to think about. Yeah. Like, you've got to think not just about your kid, but about, let's say that the fridge breaks down. Well, who has to pay for the new one or the repair guy? Or you need to have a new roof. Are you going to buy a house or a car? Whose name goes on the car? How do you figure all that stuff out? It's complicated.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in pair relationships, we've got that social script, right? We know what's going to happen, but you have to have conversations.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm just thinking about like our relationship before we got married. We never once had a conversation before that about debt. Or shared debt. We never had a conversation about filing taxes. We never had a conversation about property.
Or who was going to do what in the relationship. Like,
Exactly. And one of the questions that I had while we've been sitting here is like, you know, John Paul, I don't know if this is and you're kind of touching on it now, but like, are there things that folks who do live in polyamorous relationships, whether, you know, it's a triad or a quad or whatever the setup is, are there tips that you would give to those folks in terms of the types of conversations they should be having?
Yeah. I'm thinking like a checklist.
Like a checklist of things to go over before things get to that point of the relationship being that serious where it seems like it's going to be this like long-term commitment between 3-4 more people. Or is it the exact same things? Is it the same things that two people in a monogamous relationship really should be considering having a conversation about before they get married?
Well, so the two people at the dyadic relationship, the thing is, they rarely have a conversation about anything. Right.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, they do that preliminary kind of feeling out thing. So, you know, what are your career plans and how do you feel about kids and those other kinds of sort of, you know, when Harry met Sally kind of exploratory dialogue. Right. But the thing, though, is that there's so much that goes unspoken that, you know, you're right, Jeremy. It's like you do want to have a checklist. You know, so what I tell lawyers, right, because that's the audience, you know, that I primarily speak to about poly and poly relationships, is I say, you know, when you have a dyadic family, you know, or you're representing one of them, right? We have like a mental list that we go through, right? You know, houses, debts, child support, spousal support, you know, and all that kind of basic stuff, right? And so I can give you like comprehensive advice. The challenge, though, is to sort of push lawyers and the people involved out of that kind of really comfortable dyadic comfort zone into thinking about everything. So, you know, what I would say is, as a prerequisite, if you're entering into a poly relationship, you already have that propensity for openness and dialogue and transparency of communication. That needs to continue throughout your relationship, and it especially needs to persist and be nurtured in those really difficult initial conversations that you've got to have with the other people that are hopefully going to wind up being your partners. And what I tell lawyers is, you've got to be so much more creative and think outside the box. It's not just a matter of those, you know, checking off those four boxes about property, debt, child support, spousal support, parenting children and stuff. You've got to go further than that. You have to think about hard questions like expectations about emotional and sexual fidelity that dyadic couples never wind up talking about, because the Hallmark aisle doesn't contain a, you know, happy Valentine's Day to you and you and you section, right? It's you know, there's all these assumptions, right, that get made. But, you know, in a multi-adult family, you've got to think about what's going to happen if all of us leave the relationship. What's going to happen if just one of us leaves? What happens if one of us meets somebody else who wants to introduce them to the relationship? Is that cool or not? Can you kiss somebody else at a party or have sex with them? Do you need to obtain permission first? Do you need to just sort of let people know ahead of time? Are there rules about safe sex and stuff like that, right? So that's only a relational issue internal to the group. Mm-hmm. You have to ask yourself, how are we going to present ourselves to the outside world? Is it cool that all of us go to the Boy Scout Jamboree to celebrate our son's, you know, erecting of tents or whatever the case is, right? How many of us can go to, you know, Aunt Susie's wedding? You know, what's going to happen on, you know, meet the parent or meet the teacher nights, you know? And because I can tell you right now, they don't have enough chairs around the table, right? How's all that going to work out? And you've got to maintain that willful exercise of openness throughout throughout the early stages of the relationships while you're negotiating all this stuff, as well as through the rest, right? But you've got to sit and think and scratch your head and ask yourself hard stuff like, who's going to pay for what? Or questions that you only see in joke cohabitation agreements about how many times are we going to take out the laundry? Who's responsible, or take out the garbage? Who does the laundry? Who washes the dishes? Who's going to be cooking? What happens if one of us realizes, hey, man, I've been cooking for like the last 2 weeks and that's not fair? How do you raise that within the group? What's the framework for that? How do you resolve disputes? Because there will be disputes, right? Well, so there's so much going on and so much to think about, but it requires, like I said, that conscious, willful exercise and transparency and the moral and intestinal courage to be brave and courageous throughout, you know, all of these discussions and throughout the relationship.
It takes so much self-awareness of your needs.
Gobs of that. Gobs of that. Yeah.
How did you end up here? Like, have you always been, you know, when you were in high school, were you always kind of the mediator within your friend group, you know, or like, is this something that a role you've always sort of naturally fell into, or like what made you get into the work that you do? And on top of that, how did you fall into doing this work specifically for people who are in non-monogamous relationships and things that are like that exist outside the societal norm of just, you know, a monogamous setup?
Well, I guess how I became a lawyer, fell into lawyering, was that, I went to high school in Ontario at a time when high school went all the way to grade 13, which was 1 year, apparently, more than I was prepared to put up with. And so I failed grade 13 miserably, right? So I wound up going to art school, which would take me with a grade 12. And while I was there, I went through the purgatory of night school, eventually got my grade 13, and then went to the only university that gave me credit for my time at art college. And so at art college, though, I had fallen in love with philosophy of all things, right? Because, you know, in order to, you know, maintain their pretense of being, you know, an intellectual institution, you know, in addition to drawing and painting, which was the stuff that I was up to, you also had to take these liberal arts courses. And so I took that and managed to fall in love with learning in a way that high school and primary school had never really sort of been able to nurture in me. And so I fell in love with philosophy, went off to university, did a major in fine arts with a minor in philosophy. A major in philosophy with a minor in fine arts. That was it. Still liked it, decided that I was going to go off and do my master's. And while I'm doing my master's, I came to realize how god-awful the ivory tower was and what it was going to be like to work in that kind of environment. And I thought, God, no. But along the way, a friend of mine got busted for possession. And so I was going along with her to some of her hearings because at that time it was illegal to possess marijuana, as some of your listeners may recall. So I was going along with her to her hearings, and then she didn't have a very good lawyer. So we kept going to, you know, the wrong courtroom on the wrong day and all that. So as a result, I was in court an awful lot, you know, listening to what was going on and patiently waiting for her lawyer to show up. And along the way, the judge used something called the reasonable person test. You don't need to worry about what the hell that means. But I was sitting there and a little light bulb went on. I was like, this is philosophy. Mm-hmm. So just when I was getting really cynical and burned out on university and, you know, wondering what am I going to do with a master's in philosophy, because, you know, what that equips you to do is work at a McDonald's. I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll go to law school. That sounds like applied philosophy. It sounds like fun, right? And so I wound up going off to doing that. And then, you know, you article before you become a lawyer, and the firm I worked at did a tiny smidgen of family law stuff, but a whole bunch of civil stuff and criminal stuff. And eventually I wound up falling in love with family law. And because family law, you know, you're providing concrete help to people in situations of profound personal need. And it's gratifying to be able to help somebody at a time of such tangible crisis in their lives. And so that was easy enough. And then I guess I was around the 10 or 12 year mark of my being a lawyer and doing family law, and I got a call out of the blue about a provincial court trial involving a poly family. That was really awesome, because they were calling to consult about the appeal and what did I think about this, that, and the other thing. And so we talked about that for a while. And then a week or so later, out of the blue, the other side of the trial gave me a call also about the appeal. And so, and this was this wonderful like relationship involving, I think there were three people in the relationship at any particular time, but they all had kids together and they were all living together. They were living openly as a poly family. Their kids' friends knew that, you know, Johnny has, you know, two moms and a dad and stuff like that. And it was awesome. And but you know, so I consulted on that, thought that was really interesting. But that was the thing that sort of kicked me in the ass and made me start thinking about the law that previously I had only ever considered from the perspective of a dyadic relationship, because the whole poly relationship thing wasn't even on my horizon. It wasn't something I'd even considered. And so you wind up thinking about, God, how does this law that I've been applying for the last X number of years, how do I fit this relationship and these people and their rights, interests, and entitlements and their obligations into this framework of a law that is built for two people? Like the BC Family Relations Act at the time says each party will be entitled to half the family assets. It doesn't tell you that there can only be two people in a relationship, but boy, does that telegraph government's unspoken expectations, right? Uh-huh. Then I went off to the University of Calgary, where I ran that research institute, and because I was running it, I had some discretion about the research agenda, and I thought this would be really fun. And so I'm still tickled pink to think that, you know, I conducted Canada's first large scale national study of people who self-identify as polyamorous. And the two research papers that came out of that are still available on the website of the University of Calgary for anybody that's interested in looking them up. But that was awesome and a lot of fun and tremendously eye-opening and, you know, just so amazing. And I guess the other thing that sort of comes into this is that that original family that called me about the appeal, well, it didn't stop there. Right. You know, I moved to Calgary to run the research institute. And like about a month after I was there, I got a call from somebody else. It was about an immigration question. You know, it was a couple living in somewhere in Alberta wanting to sponsor their third into Canada. And how were the border people going to even be thinking about this, or the citizenship people? And then after that, it was another call and another call and another call. And just to give you some idea, I was presenting some of the initial findings of that research at a meeting of lawyers with the Law Society of Upper Canada. They do this annual like family law sort of educational thing, right? And it was a massive group. So inside the room, there must have been like 400 people easily, and with another 600 online. But the 400 people in the room, I said, out of curiosity, how many people here know someone who's in a polyamorous relationship? Can you put up your hands? And I kid you not, that's something on the order of about 2/3 of the room did.
Wow.
Right. Wow. So it's this thing that exists, that it's everywhere. And the vast number of respondents we had to my survey would tell you exactly that. But it's the kind of phenomenon that somehow manages to lurk just slightly beneath the visible surface of the lake. Mm. But it's so much more widespread, so much more common than people think, especially as the millennials and the generation behind them grow up with an attitude of conscious questioning of the values passed down to them by their parents.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I think that we no longer sort of treat the moral buffet that society offers to us with the assumption that it's right. You know, it's not received wisdom. We question, we think, we criticize. And that's why I think some of the names that we have for poly relationships, you know, include things like a relationship anarchy, right?
Mm.
Which, I mean, how is that anything other than giving the middle finger to Leave It to Beaver, right? It's not. It's like, I'm not doing what your relationship was like. I'm going to do what I want, right? Or a consensual non-monogamy, or all the other terms that are more or less an explicit repudiation of the received wisdom from mom and dad and their mom and dad and their mom and dad.
And so do you get
off on a tangent there?
No, it was. I mean, that was great. And one of the things that you said there that just kind of struck me is that, you know, you're standing in front of that room and you ask that question, and 2/3 of the room say that they at least know someone who's in that type of relationship. It surprises me that, you know, I while we were talking here, I brought up an article from Canadian Law Mag or CanadianLawyerMag.com about a BC judge that ruled that a woman in a polyamorous family relationship be named as the second mother to a child. And this article came out in May of this year. You know, and so it's like it's surprising to me that this isn't new. That like these aren't relationship types of relationships that are new. They have existed. They've been around. It's just so funny to me that like it's only now that we're seeing articles like this kind of pop up here in the country.
Right. So the article that you're referring to is actually about the case that I mentioned before about the BC judge and the parents, right?
Okay.
But it's just taken that long for a case to get to court, right? Mm. And remember that when we're talking about the apparent oddness of poly relationships, we're talking about like, you know, Western civilization within quote marks in the capital W and the capital C, right? The reality is that polygamous relationships are actually approved of by some Western religions, as well as by Orthodox species of Islam, mm-hmm. right? And so there are many cultures that practice traditional Sharia law, where in fact polygamous families are much more common than you would believe, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it's common throughout spots in Africa. There's places in South America, places in the Middle East where these relationships are kind of the norm. Right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, to give you an idea about just how normal this is, Ontario's family law legislation actually contains a provision that allows people who are married in polyamorous faiths still access to the family law provisions about spousal support, even though polygamy is illegal in Canada, which is mm-hmm. fascinating. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's how common it is. It's so common. They had to make that provision. So it's really a Western prejudice that, you know, frankly, had its origins with the ancient Greeks and Romans. Mm.
Turn Me On podcast. We'll be back after this short break.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is another a bit of a personal question, and I hope it's okay that I ask, but through the work that you do as a mediator and an arbitrator, someone who disputes works with like dispute resolution, how much of that work has affected your own personal relationships? You know, like I know it's a lot easier to practice what you preach, or a lot easier said than done to practice what you preach. But like, do you think this work that you do has made you a better partner? You know, a better partner in having the ability to find resolution when it comes to disputes, or to like self mediate in your own relationships?
Well, I'm still an asshole most of the time, but I think though it's given me a better appreciation of interpersonal dynamics. And, you know, I have since the beginning of my practice believed that you can't be a good family law lawyer without knowing the, you know, basic elements of psychology. I mean, you know, half the work I do is legal. The other half is sort of a armchair counselor kind of thing. Right. Mm. And so that has, I think, made me a better parent. And I think it's made me a better partner because, you know, I'm more painfully aware about how I react to others' actions and others react to my actions, and the importance of demonstrating respect even when I'm not necessarily feeling that way, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, respect for others, certain degree of insight into emotional reactions and things like that. I think that I know my kids a hell of a lot better than they think I do because of that.
You know? Right, yeah.
Yeah.
What about, since what you said about, you know, kind of giving the finger to this system that's been built around the assumption of dyadic relationships, do your peers, your professional peers, or like, do you get a lot of pushback on this?
No. You see, the thing about doing family law, right, is that man, you see everything, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't have to practice too long before nothing is capable of shocking you anymore, right? Because, you know, you deal with people, you know, from all walks of life with all interests and all kinds of ways of arranging their relationships, right? There is virtually nothing that you could tell me that would shock me about a human relationship, right? And I think that, you know, most family law lawyers take the same approach. I mean, the only ones who would sort of have that kind of sheltered bigotry would be the kinds who are fiercely religious in their personal lives and whose religion is either a conscious or an unconscious filtering mechanism for their clientele, right? But for other folks, I mean, God, like I said, there's nothing you could say that would shock me about the nature of your relationship. So for family law lawyers, it's like talking about this stuff is like, oh, really? Ooh, tell me more. This is really exciting, you know? And it is, right? Because all of us like a challenge. I mean, family law has a learning curve like no other area of law. You're constantly exposed to new ideas and challenging boundaries and assumptions and all that sort of stuff. And so most people are just sort of delighted and open to hear about this stuff, you know, and, you know, it helps those of us who have bumped into poly relationships, you know, it's like normalize that experience and realize that other family law lawyers are bumping into these issues as well and asking questions about how do you deal with that? I mean, the parenting and relationship agreement that I was talking to you about earlier, well, it wasn't just me. Each one of the other parties had a lawyer. And then there was another lawyer, a fifth lawyer, who was sort of the organizing force that was driving the bus and was responsible for drafting the agreements so that no one felt that anybody else had an unfair advantage. And so all of those lawyers are heavily involved in LGBTQ plus issues, assisted reproduction, and know their way around the ins and outs of the human psyche and all of the different relational modalities that people can find themselves in. So none of us were particularly surprised. And it was a frankly engaging, extraordinarily enriching experience. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned all of these agreements, and I just want to clarify, these agreements come to be based on, you know, conversation, lots of openness. But if you want them to actually do what they're meant to do for the in the event of the dissolution of a relationship, do they have to be signed off on by a lawyer?
So, important point. Family law agreements do not need to be approved of by a judge, by a lawyer, by a priest, a rabbi, or an imam, or your parents, right? they're a contract, just like the contract that you have with your employer, the people that you lease a car from, and all the rest, right? And so family law agreements on their own are enforceable just like any other contract. But the family law legislation of most provinces gives agreements that people make a kind of an elevated status, right? And provide tests for when those agreements can be set aside and when they have to be enforced and how they're enforced and things like that. But to sort of think about a relationship agreement in a multi-adult family, the purpose is more along the lines of having a commonly understood recipe for a loaf of bread, right? You're signing it with the expectation that this is how you're going to make bread. This is how you're always going to make bread, and that you're not anticipating that that anybody's going to try to weasel out of the bread making process or try to do it in some radically different way, right? So most people go into these agreements so that they have a shared understanding of exactly how they're going to go about baking that loaf, not because they're thinking, shit, man, I'm going to need to enforce this at some point down the road, right? Relationship agreements between dyadic couples are more about enforcement, right? Because they're about what happens when our relationship tanks. Right? Will I be able to ask for spousal support? Will I have a share of your debt? Will I be entitled to ask for, you know, half of your stable of horses and all the rest, right? But relationship agreements among multi-adult families, they're not so much about the end of the day, what happens if things go south. They're about, you know, how do we buy a new refrigerator? What happens if we want to buy a new house? What are the rules that govern our relationship? And like I said, they're more about baking bread, having that shared understanding that these are our obligations. This is the shit we've agreed to, right? And they're written down in that formal thing that looks like a contract so that, you know, everybody knows that all you have to do is go back to the recipe to find out how much sugar you're supposed to add. Right. And, you know, we and in law, we write contracts down, not because oral contracts aren't binding, but we write them down because it's really hard to argue about what the terms of the agreement are when they're written out in a piece of paper rather than when, well, we talked about this and we shook hands. Now, how many Ford Pintos were you going to give me? You know, so this way you don't argue about it. Right. Mm-hmm. So think of it as a map, a set of directions, you know, something like that, a shared understanding of what you all have agreed to about how the relationship is going to get navigated. And what do you do if you want to introduce somebody new? And what do you do if you want to buy a car, sell the car, right? What do you do if one of us decides they want to leave, right? So down the road, yeah, sure, there's all that bump about, you know, going to court to enforce and stuff like that. And, you know, you need to check the rules that apply in your specific province because some provinces don't require that your signature on an agreement be witnessed. Other jurisdictions do. Mm-hmm. Don't think any of them require the signature to be witnessed by a lawyer, but it needs to be witnessed by somebody who isn't a party to your relationship, like your next door neighbor or your mom or your dad or somebody like that. Mm.
Well, John Paul, I got to say, this has been a very enlightening conversation, and I'm really grateful that you took time out of your busy schedule to sit down and chat with us. On behalf of myself, Bridie, and all of our listeners, thank you so much. This really did mean a lot.
Yeah.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much. I've enjoyed talking.
Well, that was a very pleasant conversation with John Paul Boyd.
Right?
Yeah.
What a find. You know what?
Mm-hmm.
You told me to look up John Paul, but I can't remember if that was before or after.
It was after I did my shoot with that CBC.
Yes.
It was after I did the shoot for that CBC thing, because they told me I was driving home with the producer. She gave me a ride back to my hotel.
Okay.
And I was like, hey, by the way, like you guys have been talking to some cool folks for the show. Do you have any recommendations for like that would be good for turn me on? And she was like, oh.
John Paul Boyd.
John Paul Boyd would be.
Yeah, absolutely. Man. Because, okay, so what I was going to say is I wasn't sure if it was before or after I Googled family law and polyamory, because this was already a subject I was kind of curious about.
Right. Something you were tossing around for season 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what a great find.
Such a lovely speaker, lovely human to just shoot the shit with. And
so cool about his fine art and philosophy history.
Love
like,
that story.
Yeah. Me too. Thanks for asking that.
It was like a nice reminder too about, like, I mean, we talk about it all the time on the show, but like the importance of communication when it comes to relationships. But like just to hear it from a lawyer's perspective. You know, it sort of put a bit of a different lens on the whole notion of communication.
Yeah.
Because it really, like, to think about all of the things that you and I have never talked about or had never talked about.
Yeah.
And probably still to this day haven't talked about.
Yeah.
It's just really interesting to think about. It also made me think about, like, things that perhaps I haven't, like, considered talking to Leah about,
yeah,
that maybe it would be like a good idea. And I'm sure that like I'm not alone in that. Like I'm sure there's listeners that heard that and went, oh yeah, fuck. Because we get into relationships.
And you find yourself in them. Like you were saying, like, oh, I guess we live together now.
Yeah. Yeah. But like so while we were talking, I brought up this other law firm's website about 15 questions you should ask before getting married.
Oh, cool.
So there's financial and personal questions. The financial ones were, do you have any credit card debt? Have you filed for bankruptcy? If so, when? Do you have any real property? Real property is any building or structure attached to land, including the rights and interests to them. What is the value of your personal property? It's like none of this is romantic. You know what I mean? This is like so fucking, who will legally own our property once we're married? Are you a co-signer to any other debt? Do you want a prenuptial agreement? That's a hairy conversation, I think, for some.
Well, I mean, only if one person or two people have money, right? Like, what do you need a prenuptial agreement for? Like, I've only ever heard it in reference to celebrities and people and with lots of money.
Well, some individuals want to ensure that they won't be taken for a ride in a divorce proceeding should the marriage go south. During specifically, defining specifically what their spouse will receive in the event of a dissolution of a marriage may be of paramount importance to them. If you are marrying someone who demands that you sign a prenuptial agreement, make sure you have that agreement reviewed by an attorney. I mean, yeah, I don't know, like... But I don't think it makes a lot of sense for someone like a couple where one of the two or both have a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that's the only place where that would apply.
Right.
You know, it's like, what if you come into a relationship with like, an example would be like, you come into a relationship with someone and the person you and I get into a relationship and I have a dog.
Yeah.
It could end up where, you know, the relationship ends and you just take the dog.
Yeah.
And I'm going, that was my fucking dog.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And are you going to take me to court about that? Because that's going to be a lot of money.
You're damn fucking right. I'd take you to court about it. If we have children, will we hire a nanny? That was another question in there. Will we file taxes jointly? That was one question that you and I didn't have.
No.
Probably should have had. And then the personal questions are, I love this one. Are you still married? That's a good one. Do you have a will? That's another like important question.
Babe.
I know we got to get a will.
We need a will.
I know.
We need a will. And you know what else we need? Actually, this is another thing. Because I did go for a meeting with a family lawyer for personal reasons to talk about the property and like business that I'm starting with Todd. And just wanting to make sure everyone is protected from my various forms of debt and your various forms of debt and any potential of Todd's forms of debt. And I wanted to get this everything straight. And when I explained to her that none of us have wills, she was like, that's the first thing you need to do. And especially where you have CF like that. But babe, one thing I want to do, maybe even more than the will, because I don't really even think there's that much. It's not like you have property or a grand fortune.
I don't have any. Yeah, I don't own anything.
But like,
I own some art.
I want the art.
Okay.
Like, because I've also invested in that art.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, the power of attorney is what we really need to get for you.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is like, what happens if you get really sick?
Yeah.
Nobody legally is entitled to speak for you. I mean, it would be me as your spouse, but like that doesn't make any difference if we haven't had a fully fleshed out conversation about your wishes and your goals.
Yeah. And the thing is like, this is a conversation.
And maybe you don't even want me to be your power of attorney.
Yeah, maybe
you would want somebody else to be your power
of
attorney.
And this is one of those conversations that like, because of the situation that we find ourselves in, that's not just a conversation between you and I.
No.
Anymore.
No.
Like that is a conversation that involves Leah.
Yeah.
Perhaps even involving Todd.
Yeah.
You know?
For the record, the executor of my will not be you or Todd. It's going to be somebody I feel like.
A stranger?
It's going to be a complete stranger who's proven themselves to be really skilled at bureaucracy because it's a lot of fucking paperwork.
Yeah, no, I don't want anything to do with that.
Don't want that.
No.
So just so you know.
Donut, can you get away from the camera, please?
But
if you maybe want to catch a glimpse of our dog Donut, patreon.com/turnmeon, and you can watch our aftercare segments. going on to the rest of these questions, number 12, do you have any prior criminal convictions?
Do you?
That's a good question. Not that I know of. Would you change your name?
Nope.
Do you have life insurance?
I do.
Do you have and or want any children?
No.
So these are all questions that like, I mean, maybe you and I had conversations about like two of these 15 things.
Yeah.
Before we got married. But like the rest, didn't even think about it.
And also like I said in the conversation with John Paul, like we were young when we got married. I mean, I was 27, which is more of a realistic age to get married. You were 24.
How old are you now?
I'm 37.
You are 37?
Yeah, we've been married for 10 years. I'm 37.
You turned 37 this year.
I turned 37 in February 2021.
Holy fuck, dude. You're almost 38.
I'm almost 40.
That's crazy. I'm pushing 40, babe. That is crazy.
I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm not even 34.
Yeah.
That's cool.
But like, we didn't even know. I wouldn't have even thought to have asked you those questions. No. Not even like, no. Oh, we didn't have that conversation. It was like, I didn't know enough about adult life to ask you those questions.
So my question is this, like, you know, all right, so let's use our example here, right? Mm-hmm. We're in a polyamorous relationship. Throughout that, whatever it's been, 6-7 years of us doing this, we have been in other relationships outside of you and I. It's never been a quad. We've never had a triad. It's always been like a, it's always been kind of like a monopoly type scenario.
Never heard that term before. Thank you. Makes complete sense.
And so now we find ourselves in this situation where I'm with Leah, you're with Todd. Leah and I have been together for about a year. You and Todd have been together for what, like 4 years now? Coming up on 5 years?
Yeah. That's fucking crazy.
When do you have the conversation?
Yeah.
Like when is it that it's time to have the conversation? Because like, and then on top of that, how do you broach the conversation? I guess I know the answer to that, which is that there's no good time. There's no natural time for that to come up. Like it has to be, it's a scheduled thing. It's like an intentional scheduled thing. But like, at what point do you go, okay, now it's time to have the conversation?
Wasn't that one of our trivia questions in one of our live show games? Is like that conversation, like what is this relationship?
But that's a different conversation. Yeah, that's right. Like the conversation about what are we boyfriend and girlfriend?
Right.
You know, or whatever.
Right. Okay. I guess, you know, like it wouldn't have come up now if it weren't for, you know, getting a business loan and buying property.
See, I feel like the time for that conversation to come up is like, because I feel like this is the sort of thing that happens in relationships often. It's like you're together, you've been together for a while, and then you start like, these things start coming up in conversation where you're like, okay, like, how do you envision our future? Or like, where do you see this going?
Yeah.
You know, like, I think everyone, I don't know, I've like, Leah and I are having those conversations now where it's like, what do we envision for ourselves in the future?
Yeah.
You know, like, we're not going to get married. Kids are off the table. So like, what does our relationship look like? And I guess that, like, even in like just regular, even in typical monogamous relationships, it's
normie relationships.
Yeah. Muggle relationships. I feel like that kind of conversation tends to start around the, you know, when you're like spending a lot of time together, things get a lot more serious. Like you start to have those chats about like, what are we? Like, where do we see this going?
Yeah.
Planning about the future. And I feel like as soon as you get to that part of the relationship, then it's kind of like, okay, well, if we're talking about the future, we should also start talking about, and in polyamory, we should start talking about like how these other people are a part of this and what are the different scenarios that we could look at and see. And Donut, that toy is not the best toy for recording. I'd say just let him have it. He'll get tired of it in a second.
Better than the soccer ball.
Better than the soccer ball. He's literally digesting.
Eating. Gross. Yeah, it's a good question. And as a conflict avoidant person, I am the worst person to ask.
Same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because it for whatever reason, I know I can speak to that. Like for whatever reason, those types of topics in conversation very easily can lead to discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, discomfort, insecurity, questioning like your own reality or like questioning what you thought was. Like those types of things not tend to come up, but like can very easily spring up when you're having those more serious conversations and asking those more serious questions.
And I think
less surface level questions, I guess.
I think an important thing to remember with regards to those conversations and that those reactions to those conversations is what John Paul was talking about, the social script, which we're not even aware that it exists really until we start moving outside of it. And, you know, like big picture, our society was built on this assumption of dyadic relationships.
Yeah.
How you doing down there, Donut? You are going
just
to town.
Just going to town on this squeaky toy. Jesus, buddy. You're lucky you're cute.
And so anything that breaks us outside of that social script, that which is just like been assumed to be normal our whole lives, is going to make people, it's going to make us uncomfortable. It's outside the comfort zone.
Yeah.
And I mean, what comes up for me hearing you say that is a lot of the stuff we've actually talked about with Kendra. I'm really looking forward
Kendra
to,
Kunov.
Yeah, with Kendra yeah. Kunov, and I'm really looking forward to doing her boundaries course, which I will remind all of our listeners that she has generously offered a generous discount to, and you can find it on her website, kendrakunov.com, her course called Beyond Boundaries. It's a sort of do it in your own time. You get it's a 4-week online self-study program. But I think that when I heard Kendra Kunov talking about once you've identified, you know, once you've kind of gotten comfortable with the idea that boundaries are there, then when we bump up against those uncomfortable moments, we can kind of maybe look at it and be like, okay, so I have a need here that feels threatened or feels pushed on. And it's not up to my partner to understand that that's my boundary or that's my need. It's on me to communicate that. And so if I just have an emotional reaction to something, to you saying, hey, let's talk about how our relationship fits within my existing partnership or whatever, recognizing, oh, I'm contracting or I'm closing up in regards to what you're saying or what you're saying you want to talk about, then I guess an honesty to that and accountability to that. I'm like, oh, I'm having a reaction or even stating, I think the other day, even with Todd, I said, I have to say this because I recognize that when I'm feeling like I'm not a full bodied yes to something,
yeah,
but I don't express it and I just sit on it and wait and wait and wait.
Why do we do that? Fuck.
Oh,
I'm the worst for it too.
Well, I just said straight up, I was like, because I was so worried it was going to cause a fight. I was getting ready for school. I didn't have fucking time to get in an argument that was going to ruin my whole day.
Yeah.
So I just said, look, I have to say this because if I don't, then a month down the road, I'm going to be really resentful.
Yeah.
And I just said it. And that worked as a way with Todd and I to preface that. I didn't have to make a big deal about it. What I said was, I'm not a full-bodied yes to this.
Yeah.
And that divorced it from any sort of like, you're making me feel like this, or I even as something as ambiguous as I feel this, for me to say it's my body is not a full-bodied yes. Like, we know what that feels like. We know what a full-bodied yes or a full-bodied no feels like. Yeah, I'm kind of drawing on that with regards to thinking about these conversations and being like, how do I stand up for what I want and need in these negotiations or in these, but also this concept of like managing expectations.
Mm.
Like if we don't have these conversations and I just expect you're going to do 50% of the dishwashing and 50% of the laundry, then of course I'm going to be fucking resentful when you don't do the laundry, even though we've never had an explicit agreement.
We never talked about it.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And And I think, you know, for any listeners who might, this might be resonating for, there is something to that. Like, why do I feel so frustrated right now that Jeremy, that these dishes have been on the counter and it seems like he's just waiting for me to do them? It's because I have an unspoken expectation.
Yeah.
That you'll contribute 50% of the dishwashing.
I do all the dishwashing.
Yeah.
At my, I love having all the dishes washed.
Yeah.
Wasn't always like that, but I do now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's just so saying. It's so interesting to be in the relationship that we're in where you
I make my bed every day.
Why didn't you do that when we shared a bed? Because it's all one room.
You know, I actually, Leah got me into it.
Okay.
Into making my bed.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you don't, but she doesn't make it. You make it.
Why? She makes my bed sometimes. Yeah. Okay. Sometimes I don't get to do it because she's already done it.
That's so nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very nice.
Oh.
Sometimes I come home, the whole place is clean. I'm like, fuck, I didn't even get to do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wish, well, I don't wish, I don't regret anything, but if we were to have some of these sorts of preliminary conversations, knowing what we know mm-hmm. now about one another,
yeah, yeah.
when we went into a living situation together and got
how
married.
How different that would have been.
Can you think of anything that would have been really beneficial? I mean, you already mentioned the taxes thing.
That's huge. That would have been the most beneficial.
Like, our, well.
Taxes and debt.
Taxes and debt would have been beneficial to yeah. us for sure. But we had no idea.
We had no idea. Yeah.
We had no idea.
No.
And even how we were going to handle our finances.
Yeah.
We never, we just got a joint. We just,
but even how we were going to, even how we were going to handle introducing new people to our lives.
Yeah.
Relationship wise.
Yeah.
Like we never had we never really had pointed, intentional conversations about that before it.
No.
It was sort of like, it was always kind of in the heat of it.
Yeah.
You know, on the fly.
Because we didn't know until those yeah. things came up.
Yeah. And there were times that came up for me that, like, because we didn't talk about it, that left me feeling resentful for, like, you know, a small period of, it was very short, very small, and didn't last, but like there's a bunch of stuff like that I can think of that came up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. A lot of our stuff, I think preliminary conversations would have been about money. Cause like even things like spending habits are spending, the way yeah. we spend money is really different.
Yeah.
And the way just we perceive money is really different.
Yeah.
And not that those, you can't be different and compatible, but those things would have been really good for us to talk about
yeah.
right out of the bat. I mean, sex, of course, is a whole other thing. Like we have expectations,
yeah.
unexpressed expectations. But yeah, it's really hitting home for me how little we knew going into
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
But how also fortunate we were to end up with each other figuring these things out.
Yes.
Because it could have been very bad
mm-hmm.
had we not been able to.
Somehow we figured it out.
Somehow we figured, even the yeah. things like when we got married, we were still talking about like, oh, well, maybe we'll adopt kids someday.
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck. Yeah. Wow. Crazy.
And that yeah, just happened wild. To, it happened like, yeah, it just kind of happened that we ended up on the same page about things and
yeah.
compatible in the ways that we've done things. And I really value that conversation we have with John Paul, honestly, like
Me
to
too.
Hear how common these arrangements are. And that's got to be because they work and because they make sense on an interpersonal level and on a family system level. And because we had no inspiration for this when we went into it. It
yeah.
was, we didn't have any real life examples. So it's really reassuring to know that like, as much as we maybe refer to ourselves as relationship pioneers, like actually this has existed and has existed functionally for a long amount of time just on the.
Yeah. Well, I've never referred to ourselves as relationship pioneers as in we are the first. I've always looked at it as we are our own
right.
relationship pioneers.
Yeah.
We're doing it our way for us without anybody else in our social circle that's done it this way, you know, that like that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. We actually have a really great question from one of our listeners and patrons, which we're going to read on in a future episode, but about that, mm-hmm. articulating that kind of relationship anarchy. Mm. And we will elaborate on that more
yeah, maybe
soon.
Next week we'll hit that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about with regards to our episode today?
I mean, like I said, I really enjoyed that conversation and I'm glad that we had it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Donut's ready to sweep the floor. Donut, I guess he just took out the broom.
Man, oh man, you're just going at it, but he's having the best time of his life all by himself.
Well, I'm happy to leave it there for this week if you are.
Let's leave it at that. Folks, thank you. Oh, one more thing.
Before we leave it, I do want to thank, these are some overdue thank yous from the summer for new patrons who have been supporting us. And it means so much. I really can't stress enough that we wouldn't be still doing this without the support of our listeners. And we have a handful of people to thank this week that became patrons over the summer. So I'd like to thank Ginny, Mark, Andrew and Susie. And I'm just going to say that it appears as if when you sign up to be a patron, you can opt out of getting a show shout out.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And I don't know if in this case it was intentional or not, but we had one other patron and who's also written us some email. And I want to say thank you to you. I hope you know who you are. I won't say your name because it appears that you've opted out, but thank you as well to you and to those of you who have transitioned over to email money transfer patrons from Patreon.
Yeah.
Leah, thank you. And we have a couple of others as well that I'll write down for next week. But
folks, thank you so much for tuning in this week. Really love getting the opportunity to sit down and chat with you, even though it's a one-sided conversation. Because you make my week and it's very fun. I'm so glad that we have this platform. Thank you to our listeners. It wouldn't be possible without you. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, leave a rating and a review. If you're on Spotify, make sure the follow button has been clicked so that of course you know that the podcast is coming out every week. And to everyone else, if you are looking to support in further ways, like we said, patreon.com/turnmeon. Looking forward to next week. Looking forward to hitting that question, which is actually really fun because the question that you were talking about with this relationship anarchy thing that we're going to talk about, a patron sent in a voice memo.
Oh, yeah.
And so it'll be really fun. I'll play it on the show. And if anyone has questions and they want to like be on the show with their own voice.
Great way to do it.
Yeah, do it. And send it to turnmeonpodcast@gmail.com if you have any questions whatsoever. Folks, thank you so much. Have a wonderful week. And that is it for this week. Until next week.
Go touch yourself.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.